Where's Wagner?
I should like to tell the student to please, please come and live with British families if he wants to know what Britain is really like. He'll easily find out where he can get families who'll help him if he goes to the different police stations, wherever he is throughout Britain. They know who will have him and take him around and really show him what living is.
The answer of the Brains Trust is, if you can come, please do. And if you can't come, I hope that the answers will have helped you. At this point, just about halfway through our program, I'd like to remind our listeners that they're listening to British American Brains Trust, which comes from the studios of the BBC in London. We're going to go on now to another quickie, as we might describe it. Something calling for a quick answer. Just this. Do you look back on your childhood as the happiest time of your life? Alan Mickey?
Well, I wouldn't go so far back as childhood. I certainly would go back to my university days, or college as they were, to be strictly accurate in American education sense. If you want to know why, very briefly, I'd say that it seems now, looking back, that I worked hard in those days, but it was a process of learning rather than working simply for the job of keeping the wolf from the door and keeping baby in shoes.
Thank you. Rose Buckner.
Yes, I think my childhood was the happiest time of my life. I'll tell you why. When I was a child, to put it very briefly, the world was mine. Now, as a matron, I feel very small and humble indeed. The world, it doesn't belong to me any longer.
Jack McPurgo?
Now that I'm a parent, I certainly do look back at my childhood as the happiest days of my life, yes, for the benefit of my own children. But I don't believe that at the time I thought that they were particularly happy days. I was frequently very miserable. More frequently, I suppose, than I am now.
Gilbert Harding.
My answer is emphatically no. I don't look back at my childhood with any pleasure or satisfaction at all. In the first place, I stammered very badly, which I found embarrassing and upsetting. I wasn't at all happy, and I didn't like it in the least. But now I realize, like the poet Thomas Hood, that it is little joy to know I'm further off from heaven than when I was a boy.
Oh. Well, there you have the opinions of the Brains Trust, which are mixed as usual. The next question comes from an English girl married to an American in Washington, D.C. And she wants to know, how important are your first impressions when you are making up your mind whether you like people or not? Rose Buckner?
Well, I'm the type of person who goes by first impressions. I either like a person or I don't, and I never change my mind.
Well,
oh dear.
I find I'm usually right from my own point of view.
Oh, no. Nice.
Well, Gilbert Harding, well, what will you say about it?
The question is, how important are your first impressions? I'd say they are extremely important, because in my case, they are almost invariably wrong.
Oh.
And therefore, they should be avoided and mistrusted. There's a certain arrogance, I think, in thinking that your first impressions are always right.
Well, you may be right there, but do you know, many people go by my first impressions, so shall we call it woman's intuition?
Yes, I think perhaps we'd better.
Yes. And I should be quite happy to do that.
Yes, of course.
What about Alan Mickey?
Well, I would again go back into my own personal experience, which is largely that of newspaper work, where first impressions, particularly in interviews and meeting people, are of the utmost importance. In fact, many times you aren't given an opportunity for second impressions. You've got to make a quick, on-the-spot judgment of the person you're talking to, and in a very few minutes, perhaps when conducting an interview, make some effort to sum up that person's personality, his background, something of his own likes and dislikes. I don't mean to say that that is sufficient always to make me determine whether I like the person or not, but I find that with that experience, that it is possible for me, and in this case, I would come over and agree with Rose Buckner, it is possible for me then, to my own satisfaction, 9 times out of 10, to make my own judgment, and to find that if I have, on the first impression, decided that the person is all right, to find that it will be substantiated later on.
Jack McPurgo.
Well, I'm terrified of all this, because if I went by my first impressions, I don't think I'd like anybody. I always have to wait for a second, third, and even fourth impression before I can make up my mind.
A neat division of opinion here. Half the Brains Trust thinks that they are very important. Half the Brains Trust thinks they are most suspicious. I must say that I'm on the side of Gilbert Harding and Jack McPurgo. I think it may depend on whether yours is an analytical
or an emotional approach, but we won't go into that. And here's a question from an American girl studying at London University. She wants to know, can you enjoy a good reproduction as much as the original painting?
Gilbert Harding?
I'm supposed to be dreary about this again, but of course it does depend so much on the reproduction. Just lately, in England, once again, they've started making some admirable reproductions. And in Canada, there's a process called the silk screen, which, to people like myself, few of whom are prepared to admit, form the vast, vast majority of people who really don't know or care very much. Of course, you can enjoy the reproduction, I think. It's nice is the proper word, I suppose, really, to see the original thing. The only painting which has ever made a lasting impression on me, because I'm not what is known as artistic, is Rembrandt's Man in Armour at the Glasgow Art Gallery, which I enjoyed enormously in the original. And because I liked it so much, I've bought and given away several reproductions, and I look at it with great pleasure. And I suppose it depends on the reproduction.
Yes? Rose Buckner.
Yes, I enjoy a good reproduction. You see, in the middle-class home and in the poorer home, we can only have good reproductions. But I find the children love to go to the museums and the art galleries to see the originals. I think it gives them a great love of the original, if in the home there is a good reproduction.
Jack McPurgo.
I think there is a certain thrill in seeing the original that you can never get out of a reproduction. It's nothing to do with the quality of the painting. It's something to do with the very fact that you know that the painter did paint that thing himself. But so far as quality goes, there is, incidentally, a French process now, which I'm told that only the very most highly trained experts can differentiate from the original. And I don't think that the question of enjoying it as aesthetic pleasure can be argued at all. You can enjoy one as much as the other.
Alan Mickey?
Well, I would only like to say that I would agree with Gilbert Harding in the sense that it depends very much on how good the reproduction is of what particular picture or painting. For example, I think Jack Morpurgo would agree with me that nothing could match the thrill, let's say, of seeing the original Dutch masters in the museum at The Hague. I've never yet found reproductions good enough to give you that same feeling of being actually in the museum and seeing the original paintings. Yet, on the other hand, I don't have the same feeling, for example, about painters like Van Gogh. I feel that reproduction has reached such a high art nowadays that it is possible. In fact, I own a few reproductions that give me almost as much satisfaction, in the sense that at least I can see them every day rather than making trips to the galleries, than I get out of the originals.
Thank you. I think that sums up the opinion of the Brains Trust, too. If the reproduction is really good, you can enjoy it almost as much as the original painting, but there is at the same time a certain thrill about seeing the original painting, which no reproduction, however good, can really evoke.
In the next question,
a Bostonian writes, British visitors over here have always to be reminded that New York isn't America, though few seem to believe it. Does London dominate Britain as strongly? And if so, does the Brains Trust approve or disapprove of this tendency? London and Britain. Rose Buckner,
yes.
I can see you want to say something.
Well, I don't think that London dominates Britain. When the American tourists in particular come over here, the first thing they seem to want to do is to get right to Scotland. So I think that dominates Britain every time.
Helen Mickey.
Well, as a Scot, I like that, but I would still have to disagree in the sense that again, as a working newspaper man, it's my opinion that London, in every sense, does dominate Britain. London is Britain in the sense that unlike America, and this is where the point of difference comes in, your capital, your center of government, if you wish to put it, the center of a worldwide commonwealth, is here in London. The financial aspect of the city, the heart of publishing, newspaper work, all of that is here. In the U.S., as I said before, the reason why you get the reminder that New York isn't America is the fact that In everything except government, let's say, New York is the center of America. But unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on whether you're a Washingtonian or not, Washington is still is the center of the American government. And there again, because of the great physical distances behind New York and Washington, you have to have the added reminder that you've got to see a great deal more of the country in the United States before you really get to know it than you do here in Britain.
Well, Jack McPurgo.
Well, we're all talking about America, and I must talk a little more about America. It seems to me that Alan Mickey has hinted at one of the reasons for the difference, and that is that the American newspaper center is not New York. That the average American outside of New York never sees a New York newspaper, whereas most people in this country do at some time or another read either a daily or a weekly English newspaper, a London newspaper. And in that, their opinions come so much from London that London has dominated England and even Scotland.
I still don't agree. It's my opinion that Americans coming here can't get out of London quick enough to see Shakespeare's country and, ever so many more places.
Since when was Shakespeare born in Glasgow?
You're retarding. We haven't heard from you on this. We really must hear from you.
I must say, Rose Buckner makes me say that whenever I hear Scots talking about Home Rule, I always say I'd support it because it means Home Rule for England as well. But I'd like to ask Alan Mickey a question first. Do people in America, in the United States, that is to say, make a habit of coming to New York the same as people in Great Britain try to get to London?
No, physically you couldn't do it.
Exactly, that's what I mean. I think London does. I wouldn't say dominate so much, but London plays a much more important part in our life than New York does in American life, simply because it's a much smaller country. Isn't that right?
Quite.
And I think that sums up the opinion of the Brens Trust too. London does, in some sense, dominate the life of this country, though whether we approve of it or not depends whether we come from London or from elsewhere. Myself, I'm a Welshman. And now to end off with, here's another quickie. It comes from a listener in northern Ohio who asks, if you could have been born when you were, 50 years earlier or 50 years later, which would you have chosen and why? Rose Buckner?
I would like to be born 50 years later, because then I could visit anywhere I wanted all over the world. And by that time, I think we'll be much closer to each other because of the aeroplane and the way it has put out distances.
Thank you. Alan Mickey.
Well, I too, would prefer to have been born 50 years later because I already know what happened 50 years earlier, and I would very much like to know what's going to happen 50 years in the future.
Jack McPurgo?
Well, reactionary to the last, I'd rather have been born 50 years earlier. I don't believe the story that 50 years later I would have been able to know much more about the rest of the world. It strikes me that the closer the nations get together physically, the less we understand about each other.
Yeah.
And I would like to have been born 50 years before I was. That would have landed me up with all sorts of dreary problems among dreary Victorians.
And the other time?
Well, if I was curious as Rose Buckner, wanting to know what's going on and seeing of other people, which I'm not, then I'd rather have been born 50 years earlier, because 50 years ago I could have gone to Russia if I liked, and I've got into the United States with comparatively little difficulty. One is an iron curtain, the other is a silken curtain. They're both rather difficult to penetrate. I'd certainly rather have been born 50 years ago, because then the only thing I should have to be afraid of would have been a curious thing called the mitrailleuse, which was afterwards a machine gun and the howitzer, which I must say I'd rather put up with than atomic bombs and biochemical warfare and all the other horrible things that the ideologists on both sides of the Atlantic seem to frighten us with from morning until night.
And Gilbert Harding and I wouldn't have needed passports.
No.
Well, there it is. Two of the Brains Trust would like to have been born 50 years ago, and two of the Brains Trust would like to be born 50 years hence. And those two figures, if you work them out, neatly cancel each other out.
You can draw what conclusion you will from that. And now we must draw our program to a close. If you've got a question for the panel here in London, would you send it, please, to the British American Brains Trust, Broadcasting House, London, England, when we shall be glad to discuss it. And now, on behalf of Rose Buckner, Gilbert Harding, Jack McPurgo, and Alan Mickey, this is David Lloyd James saying goodbye to you from the studios of the BBC in London.
You've been listening to the British American Brains Trust. The speakers were Rose Buckner, Gilbert Harding, Jack McPurgo, and Alan Mickey. Question master was David Lloyd James. This is the British Broadcasting Corporation.